Yes, so I think I'll just start with a couple of thank yous, actually. I'm going to thank Imogen and Jeremy, who have... I had this idea of showing a few clips from a film called Samsara, and I thought, I'll ask Imogen. And she was straight away up for it, and then Jeremy got pulled into the whole thing. And it's taken them quite a few hours, I think, to produce something that we're going to see a few minutes of later. So thank you very much. You know, I hope that will add to the evening. I thought it might be another way of conveying something about the talk. And of course, thank you to Ratnagosha for the shrine and the Sangha Tuesday night team for setting this all up. Thank you all. And thank you all for coming. And it was funny while I was sitting there meditating, because I was not really meditating. I was thinking, where is the Viriyajyoti who just said, oh yes? Where's she gone? Disappeared, I'll tell you. Anyway, I am delighted to give this talk, because it is a subject very, very close to my heart. And I think because of that, it can make it quite difficult in a way, or it does for me. I think I've been pondering it for quite a long time, actually, thinking about it, and then trying to bring it together and to do justice to stillness, simplicity and contentment. And I've actually changed the talk a bit while I was sitting there meditating, and I thought I'd really like just to start thinking about the Buddha and just recollecting the Buddha back over 2,500 years ago, sitting under the Bodhi tree, and this commitment to stay put and until he could, you know, until he attained enlightenment, until he understood the cause of suffering and had some answers to that. And I was thinking about the Buddha just really sitting there, that vow to stay there as long as it takes, and about Mara and Mara turning up and sending all of these forces, you know, forces that were actually, of course, all in the mind, but like armies, sending armies against the Buddha to frighten the Buddha from his position, from this stillness. And then sending, sensuous maidens, you know, coming along to try and pull him off his seat, draw him in, pull him away into a realm of craving. And but him just sitting still. And then finally challenging his right to sit on to sit there. Who are you to sit there? You know, you can sort of imagine it. Trying to create doubt in the Buddha's mind. And the Buddha simply touching the earth. I'm sure we all know this story, just sitting there and touching the earth. And I just think that is the most beautiful image of stillness and simplicity and contentment, really. And transforming all of those craving, fearful, doubting mind states into flowers, and then just falling like rain. And I think that's just a beautiful, beautiful image. So maybe we could just hold that in mind, you know, evoke that sometimes ourselves. So as Ratnagosha was saying, there's the negative form of the precept. So I undertake to abstain from sexual misconduct. And the positive, with stillness, simplicity and contentment, I purify my body. And similarly to Ratnagosha, I really love the latter. And it sounds so different, doesn't it? You know, it just sounds so attractive or something, to abstaining from sexual misconduct. And when we think of that precept, just thinking a little bit about the negative, because I'm going to focus much more on the positive precept this evening, on the positive stillness, simplicity and contentment. Just thinking about, it's more than about sexual misconduct, it is about any sort of craving that really has us in its grips. And the result of that craving can sometimes be acting out acting out of that craving and grasping and taking, either, you know, taking people or objects or things, you know, for our own needs. So it doesn't have to be sexual desire. It could be other sorts of cravings. So one thing I think, just maybe to say about on the abstention side, I thought it can be very clear sometimes. It seems a lot quite clear to me, like to abstain from craving, you know, from turning craving into grasping, from when we grasp something. Sometimes I think it is a really good practice to have in our repertoire or something, that we can sometimes just sort of stop it, you know, just... we do abstain, we don't do it, you know. The longer we practice, the more we practice, the more we see the suffering caused by acting out of a craving mind, and the more we can really, really just try not to do that. You know, it just creates suffering for ourselves and others. So I think it can be quite a clear thing, the abstention side. But the stillness, simplicity and contentment, I see it's more like really cultivating and developing those qualities alongside sometimes just having to not act out of craving, but alongside you keep developing these qualities, and over time that eventually the craving isn't present or the grasping isn't there. So that's sort of the way I'm trying to go with the talk. And I thought maybe we could begin by reflecting or just feeling into the actual felt experience of craving, because then we can sort of feel into the very opposite of that. So what is it like to be, you know, in the clutch or a craving? You know, what is it like to be really caught in a craving mind state? You know, maybe you can just think about that. What's it like when you're caught in such a craving? And I was thinking about it as it can be so painful. You know, it's dukkha. It's you're caught. It's got this sort of compulsive quality to it. It's sort of in the driving seat. It's sort of pushing you to act, to grab, to grasp. And that grasping can go onto a person or an object. And I think the more ethically aware one becomes, the more painful it becomes. I don't know if that resonates with you, but your craving itself is so unpleasant. And it's not as if any of us would want it. You know, you wouldn't choose to have an experience of craving. I think it requires a compassionate response. That's what I'm saying. You know, it requires real compassion. So in my experience, when I'm craving, the mind and the body, they become tight and rigid, you know, and I feel my body gets smaller, sort of get like that, you know, that sort of graspy sort of quality. Very, very unpleasant. And you just see the object of your craving and want it or something. You sort of miss the whole thing that's going on around. And in that way, I think people and things just become objects. I think that's one part of, you know, that I've really, really been contemplating and reflecting as I think about this talk, how we objectify people, you know, and things. And Banti talks about needing to see people as ends in themselves, not as a means to an end. And I think that's such a good distinction. You know, when you objectify something, you just see it as a means to an end for yourself. But if you really see something as an end in its own self, you couldn't grasp it, you couldn't crave it or something like that. So when we're really caught in craving, we may grasp and we take what is not freely given. So it starts to touch on the other precepts. So taking the not given. And in a way, harming another. And harming the object of our craving. Whatever that is. And of course, harming ourselves when we're doing that. So I was saying a moment ago, no one wishes to experience craving. I don't suppose anybody here, I certainly don't want to experience craving. I don't suppose any of us does. But time and time again, we get caught by it. And it's such a strong thing, and such a strong experience. It can really make us act out. And of course, it's a longer spectrum. Some craving will be less intense than others, but sometimes it could be incredibly intense. So I was thinking, well, what can we do, you know? And I think this is where we start to move into stillness. I was thinking about really needing to stay with our experience, a bit like the Buddha. And, you know, we talk about the nidana chain, and some, I think most of us will be familiar, that we experience vedana, you know, we experience feelings, sensations in the body as painful, pleasant or neutral. And if we can create a space of stillness, we can really tap into that. Notice what's actually happening within our experience and not slip into craving so easily. So we can start, we're just starting to try and be more aware. We talk about trying to find a gap. I don't know if we're all familiar with that expression. But finding a gap where there's a possibility of doing something different. But you need to be aware of what's happening in your experience. So between feelings that arise in the body, feelings that are pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, there is this possibility of just really staying with it. Not doing anything with it, and it all just fades away, just dissolves on its own. Or it takes us into the realm of craving. And craving can then take us into the whole realm of grasping. So what we're trying to do is try and create space wherein we can start to notice what's going on, becoming more aware, being more still. And I was thinking out of craving, not only are we harming ourselves and other beings, we're harming the planet. Really thinking about that. And it's all quite, if we act out of craving, if we get into grasping, it's just quite a pointless, painful exercise. And it's full of dukkha. That's what I thought. And so the more we know that experience and the more metta we can bring to it, the more friendliness and tolerance, the more we can just bring compassion to the whole experience. And I really want us to hold that in mind as the importance when we're caught in craving, just bringing compassion to ourselves and also recognising that other people are caught up in craving and bringing compassion to them too. It's what we do until we're very, very spiritually advanced. So now I'm going to move into the realm of stillness, simplicity and contentment from that stage of craving. So I feel that's like the antithesis of a craving mind. It would be like, the craving mind would be like this murky, turbulent lake, all stirred up, no clarity. And then on the other side, we've got this stillness. It would be like a crystal clear lake, absolutely transparent. And, you know, if we think of the mind like that, how beautiful that could be. That would be so seeing with clarity, utmost clarity, seeing everything. And at this point, I feel sort of relief. I wrote on my notes, oh, you know, just thinking about stillness. we found the gap. You know, you move into that gap of stillness. I feel relief just getting to that point away from craving, just thinking about craving. So I thought I'm going to read this poem by Pablo Neruda, and it's called Keeping Quiet. And in a way, I think it could be almost the talk with the clips later and everything. But I'll read it to you all. Maybe you can just listen and allow it to drop into your being, like a lake. It could be like little lakes out there. Keeping quiet. Now we will count to 12 and we will all keep still. For once on the face of the earth, let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for 1 second and not move our arms so much. It would be an exotic moment, without rush, without engines. We would all be together in a sudden strangeness. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales, and the man gathering salt would look at his hurt hands. Those who prepare green wars, wars with gas, wars with fire, victories with no survivors, would put on clean clothes and walk with their brothers in the shade, doing nothing. What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life is what it is about. I want no truck with death. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving, and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt this sadness of never understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us, as when everything seems dead and later proves to be alive. Now I'll count up to 12 and you keep quiet. And I will go. So when I first heard this poem, and still hearing it or reading it now, I'm struck by it. I don't know, there was something about the power of it. I was absolutely struck by the power of all of us being silent in unison. I had this real sense of like it happening all over the world, and what it would be like. And I imagined all human beings stopping, just looking at each other, seeing their fellow humans and all animals and beings of all types in the whole world and the planet, as if for the first time, as if woken from a dream. And when I was walking along to the centre tonight, I was looking at people with this sort of sense of what would it all be like now if we stopped and we just all looked around. And I thought we might wonder, what on earth are we doing? How did life get to like this? You know, there's so much craziness. And I don't know, I found it very, very powerful. I don't know, it may or may not resonate with you. And I was thinking about out of that stillness, how there was this, the fishermen can no longer harm the whales. It's like, you just see with utmost clarity that everything is exquisite and everything is an end in itself. You know, it's not an object. You know, it's got this life. And the man looking at his hurt hands, I just thought about all the people, you know, who were really struggling. And it really spoke to me of waking up, like you wake up, like, with, you know, you suddenly would see clearly, and we'd all do it. I had this idea that I'd like to sort of set up something like, you know, try and get one of those things that go virus around the world so the whole world tried it. But I have no idea how to take that on. Maybe that's the next project. But I really had a sense that it would be potent. You know, we could, you know, if we could all stop together. Anyway. So I was thinking, when we're asleep, we quite mindlessly, unconsciously fall into craving, and then we can fall into grasping. So we just need to keep that awakeness. How do we do that? And another example I thought of when I think of that poem is, I remember seeing my mother before, in the weeks running up to her death. And, you know, she was nearly 80 years old. And I think for the first time ever, I saw her as a being in her own right. I really saw her. She wasn't just my mother. She was a being in her own right. And my only regret from that was not really finding out, not really having the opportunity then to ask about her with total interest and with nothing invested from myself. So there's something about that. So I think what I'm trying to communicate with this is, from this stillness, simplicity, contentment, is there's this opportunity to see more clearly, you know, to see the beauty and majesty of all things. And, yeah, see things as if for the first time, you know, if we have that sort of mind state. And when that happens, it would be almost impossible to crave or to grasp that, you know, that being or that thing. So some of the ways I thought about that might be helpful for people thinking about how to move into that realm of stillness would be around perhaps doing the doing nothing practice. That was one of the things that I've really taken on. And I think it was Maitreya Bandu who talked about it here. And I've really tried to do that more and more, just sit in a chair, just sit still, do nothing. He talked about, I think he called it, if you sit there long enough, something, the energy feels a bit like a coiled spring. It's like something wants to leap into action and do something. But just learning to be with that and allowing that just to transform. Because there's a sort of compulsive quality to that. So we're learning how to not act on those compulsions, to be more still. And I thought the experience can be very uncomfortable and disquieting at times, but if we can just stay put with awareness and kindness and witness shifting energies just moving around, starting to recognise what pushes us and pulls us, and just letting it be, letting it just transform into flowers in a sense. And of course it's much easier said than done. You know, it's a challenging practice, but it's, of course we can do it, you know, just really try and do it. And of course we can sit in meditation, meditating more, sitting with whatever arises. Just allowing experience to come and go. Seeing that all our thoughts and feelings and emotions just arise and pass if we don't grasp onto them. They don't have any power in themselves. We're just trying to see that in meditation. And doing the metta bhavana, you know, for me that has become just such an important practice, I think, as part of this. Starting to just see all beings. Just seeing all beings equally with love and kindness. That all beings are sensing themselves. And also I thought maybe we could find little pools or puddles of stillness in our life. Wherever and whenever we can find them. I've started trying to, I've noticed when I come out of the door from Abbey House in the mornings, I'm just trying to come out of the door and then look up at the sky, and on the way to work, you know, I just keep sort of opening up and just taking everything in, you know, just allowing the mind to be more still but spacious. And I also thought maybe if we use a car, we could cycle more. Or if we use a cycle, we could walk more. And if we walk more, we sit more. And so on. I was just thinking, just slowing down. So although ultimately we need the mind to be quiet, we need to slow the body, probably, to help that process. So I'll just talk now maybe a little bit about simplicity. So I've spoken about stillness. So out of stillness, it seems that maybe simplicity will quite naturally arise. You know, sometimes we might actively pursue simplicity, try and simplify our life in some way, maybe decluttering, all of that sort of thing, not having so many things. Just having a sense of, what does it mean to us to live a simple life? You know, what does it mean? We could ask ourselves that, contemplate that. But generally, I feel personally, and in my own experience, that more stillness naturally leads to a desire for a more simple life. And going on, being in nature or going on retreats, they sort of bring that simplicity out in your life. Being on retreat, no meditation, no technology, no media, nothing to do. You know, just turning up. And I thought about going on solitary. There's an expression somewhere about the beauty of fetching water and chopping wood. And I think there is this beauty in this simplicity of these things. If we can drop into that space of stillness and put ourselves in the conditions. I was thinking about noticing the beauty of moss on wood, you know, just moss growing or something. You know, if your mind's very still and all those simple things seem very beautiful. So, and I was thinking about on my 3-month ordination retreat in the Spanish mountains in Akashavana, the simplicity of having a shower standing in a bucket, you know, and returning home and finding flushing the loo was painful, you know, because it was just extraordinary. And at first I used to collect all water from different ways and start pouring it down the loo. But eventually it wore off, you know, it just wore off. But it was very, very strong at the time. And I remember the ants at Akashavana, watching the ants, these great big ants carrying goods around on their back and then having these little communications with each other. And it was endlessly wonderful. It was just fascinating. But it's that simplicity. And Claire and I were talking about the rock doves. We've got a pair of rock doves that are nesting outside our office. And we've had so much joy from the, you know, just watching those rock doves sit there day after day, you know, and the simplicity of it. And of course, this isn't my whole experience, and it won't be all of our experience. Of course, craving still arises. And, you know, I definitely notice I want things often to be different to the way they actually are. And then I just keep trying to recall, just to come back to the pure sensations of the experience, try not to act on it, try to be still, meditate where possible, recall the Buddha and Mara. I often recall the Buddha and Mara. I find that quite helpful. Because I think if the Buddha was assailed with those sorts of mental states, of course I'm going to be, aren't I? Much more so. And I'll be much more blown around, as we all will. Okay, so I'll say a little bit about contentment. So what is contentment? What is it? What is the experience of contentment? Can you recall a moment, time of contentment? What was it like? You know, reflect on this. What was happening at the time and what conditions gave rise to it? You know, what happens to lead to contentment? And I was thinking, you've got stillness, simplicity, and more contentment has this possibility to arise. So when one is content, one is fully present in that moment, not wanting to be anybody else, anywhere else, and not needing anything else. It's like, there's nothing else needed. That's contentment. And I remember once having this particular experience. I've had many experiences of contentment, but this particular time, I was walking out and it was a windy day and my coat was blowing open wide. And I imagined I was a bird about to fly and started messing around with my coat instead of doing that. I remember that the thought arose, if I was to die now, that would be fine. I felt absolutely at peace with myself and the world, and I thought, oh, this is contentment. This is contentment. And I'll just read a poem by Banti where he talks about contentment. At the wood's edge, a solitary hut, sharing my quiet room, a single friend. Here on the table, two or three books of verse. There on the shelf, half a dozen frost-blackened violets. Hour after hour, we exchange only a few words. Day after day, I polish a single poem. Who would have thought it? A whole world of content found in these things. But that was, you know, very evocative, just getting at those very simple things. So for us, just looking for the conditions that lead to contentment, what are they for us? How am I doing for time, Matt Negoshi? What time do you want me to finish?
Another 10 minutes.
Oh, gosh, okay. Okay, so I'm going to say a little bit, because Rat Negotia talked a bit about the practice of my being an Anagarika, having this goal kesa. So becoming an Anagarika means literally becoming homeless one. And, of course, I'm not homeless in the sense that I don't have a home, but it's much more about trying to live very, very simply, as simply as one possibly can, and also to live outside of sexual relationships. But for me, that felt absolutely, you know, it wasn't why I became an Anagarika. I haven't been in a sexual relationship for years, you know, for about 16 years or so. It was much more to do with something about simplicity. And I really, really longed to be able to live more simply and to be more free from craving. And I, you know, I had this, just this sense of being freer of possessions and things. And the final catalyst to my decision to becoming an Anagarika was watching the film Samsara, which some of you may have seen, which we're going to see some clips of in just a moment. I was living in Tara Loka at the time. It was the beginning of 2014. I found the film almost unbearable to watch. I didn't make it to the end. I sat watching it with the community, the women in Tara Loka. I couldn't make it to the end. It was too much. And it was as if the film was just really waking me up. And there was a part of me that found that so hard. And it was only later, I remember being on a metta retreat, and it just came into my mind that my response to suffering and craving was going to be taking the step of becoming an Anagarika. And I was daunted, seriously daunted by it. I didn't know what it would mean. I was worried that it would mean a lot of giving up things, and but it felt very clear that that was going to be my next step. And then I met up with lots of other Anagarikas and we talked about it, and I got much more in touch with the path. It's a path to freedom, it's a path to liberation, it's a path to stillness, simplicity and contentment, and that's the path I really, really want to follow. Okay, so, and of course at times I feel very daunted and totally inadequate to the task. But I keep trying to come back to cultivate stillness, simplicity and contentment, and that will have its own effect and fruits. So I think what we'll do now is we're going to watch these parts of samsara that Imogen and Jeremy have woven together, that we chose together, that I hope evoke something for us all. And we'll see.
Thank you.
So I'm just going to end after that, just with a poem that was read out at my Anagarika ceremony. And it's something, it's a poem by Nandutara, who was a Buddhist nun around the time of the Buddha. And I'm going to finish with this because I think it reflects the tensions of something. It certainly reflects the tensions for me in my life, I think some of the tensions that it showed in that film. And yes, and just really encourages thinking of it's really difficult to practice to free ourselves from craving. But it's so worth it, and just to really practice stillness, simplicity and contentment as much as we possibly can, and recognise when we can't with a lot of kindness. And here's Nandutara's poem. I used to worship fire, the moon, the sun and the gods. I bathed at fords, took many vows. I shaved half my head, slept on the ground and did not eat after dark. Other times I loved makeup and jewellery, baths and perfumes, just serving my body, obsessed with sensuality. Then faith came. I took up the homeless life. Seeing the body as it is, desires have been rooted out. Coming to birth is ended, and my cravings as well. Untied from all that binds, my heart is at peace. So that is the end of my talk, and I do hope that it helps you all or benefits beings in some shape or form. Thank you.